My question is, why do things keep getting more advanced the further we go back into time? That's contradictory, right? It shouldn't get more advanced stonework, more advanced technology, and yet that's what we see.
An incredible thing to claim has caused a massive response from both the alternative research community and the mainstream sectors.
I would love this kind of stuff to be true, but it is total bullshit. They're using a method that has never been presented before in depth. It's never been tested. It follows all the rules of pseudoscience.
When they've tested it on the Gran Sasso Laboratory in Italy, and they tested this technology on the Mosul Dam in Iraq, and Filippo Biondi, the guy that actually proposed this whole Doppler synthetic aperture radar fusion, has done it on structural integrity for bridges, findings like this from the Giza Plateau. Maybe 10, 20 years ago, they wouldn't be able to do as much, but now we're in a different space. They can't shut down the conversation as easily. Podcasts are able to completely overtake the mainstream narrative control of the modern world. Göbekli Tepe in Turkey and so many other incredible megalithic sites around the world that just defy explanation of the current model. It was so shocking when Ancient Apocalypse came out on Netflix and you just saw like Rolling Stones, New York Times, The Guardian. This is such a dangerous conspiracy theory adult documentary. It's far right. The water erosion is just such a strong signature. It's such a very important one, and especially because they made active attempts to literally destroy evidence. I mean, covering up fissure lines is destroying evidence, right? So like, that's what they were doing. Incredibly sophisticated architecture that mimics, whether that mimics this or this mimics that, can't tell which one came first. But when I went to Malta, so many of the stone building projects there just look like Newgrange in Ireland. It's just like, huh. So why are there these global similarities and this pattern? Christopher Dunn, who's an engineer who went out to Egypt, very famous for going out and finding so many of these machining tool marks that are just clearly evidence of something more advanced than copper tools and copper drills and sand abrasive, which is what they tend to say is used for these drilling holes. And they're just so clear and obvious. Like I said, there is a global pattern of shared archaeology, shared advancement in stone building from what are primarily, when you speak to the indigenous cultures, lost civilizations. They're not attributed to that civilization. We do it. We attribute it to the Incas or the ancient Greece or Rome with the, you know, Temple of Jupiter. But the indigenous stories almost always will talk about lost civilizations. And a lot of the times they reference giants, man. Like, I don't know what to think about that.
On this episode of the Hodgecast, I have the absolute esteemed pleasure of welcoming Jay Anderson to the show. Jay Anderson from his hit YouTube channel, Project Unity. I first come across Jay, like most people, watching the or listening to the Joe Rogan Experience, the episode, I don't know the number, but it was with Chris Williamson, and he played your clip. Yes. That must have been a good honour for you, surely.
It was. Thanks for inviting me, by the way. Pleasure to be here. That was a pretty crazy moment, I'm not going to lie. I wasn't expecting it to hit Joe Rogan levels, but I'm happy that that clip went out there and it caused a pretty significant boost in people checking out what I had to say on the pyramids and the studies. And then luckily, I was able to get the first interview with the scientist in English. So that was a good kind of bonus round as well. And I'll be at a conference in June as well in North Carolina, speaking to them on stage, and I'm going to be hosting that. So looking forward to that as well.
Well, that's awesome. So has it literally just skyrocketed from that clip being played on Rogan?
Yeah, man. I mean, like I've had a deep interest in prehistory specifically for quite a while. So that's something I've been working on, and I've actually got a documentary in the making from Malta. Went to the islands of Malta recently. So that was kind of like a sideline, because I've also been involved in the UFO subject and like kind of black budget technologies and all sorts of different like high energy consciousness studies, a whole mixed bag of, I guess, the fringe stuff that people don't want to talk about. You know, it's not acceptable to speak about. So this was a pretty big boost in terms of like the pyramid coverage and like going into prehistory, because that's something that I really want to focus on. It's kind of caught me up in a bit of a fervor, because the implications of the pyramids and what could be underneath them is a really interesting angle, because it's not existing in a vacuum. This study in the Giza Plateau is coming off of the back of like literally thousands of years of statements about there being underground tunnels and labyrinths and networks and halls of records under the Giza Plateau. So it ties into a lot of historical reference, and it's exciting that they're bringing it up. But yeah, it was a pretty crazy few weeks for me, that's for sure.
Listening to you now, I'm so gassed for this interview, because I know we're going to go deep down the rabbit hole.
Oh, for sure, man.
So, I mean, one of the things, we ask a question to all our guests, but before we get onto that, I just want to, because a lot of the misconceptions were, because your video was the most viral about this subject, and I think still is, People just assumed you was part of the project, didn't they? Or certainly, I've read the comments. A lot of people thought Jay Anderson was a part of the what's the name of the project?
It's the Kafir Pyramid Project. That's so the Kafir Pyramid, which is the second largest, and it's the one in the middle on the Giza Plateau. And I guess people thought I was connected to it because, again, my video got a lot of coverage. But there was a couple of people that I'd seen, because I'm plugged into that whole world of prehistory and, you know, people who are in the alternative research space, what's going on there. And a couple of little YouTube channels uploaded it. So I looked into it, and it turned out that there was these scientists in Italy who had these incredible claims, and they had these scans. So I just put the video together as quick as I could. I did make a couple of errors in that video, regrettably. But yeah, people assumed I was part of the project. I wasn't part of the project, just happened to get a lot of views on that video. But since then, I've been in contact with the team, and I'm still in contact with the team. And I'm just hoping that they can bring some new findings, some new scans, some new studies to this, because one of the issues with this is because they're having to use non-invasive technology. There's only so much they can do other than just continuous scanning over the next few years. People are saying, oh, it's all gone very quiet. Where's the next bit of information? Well, it's going to take some time, you know, because this is scientific research being done, tomography scans using satellites. You know, this takes a lot of time to figure out. So I would not be surprised if the Egyptian government was giving them some pressure in terms of any sort of excavation, because they're not into that. They do not want people excavating. There's nothing suspicious about the pyramids, but we can't dig around them at all.
That's a real bugbear, isn't it?
It is.
With people like Zawi Hawass, who just have a massive stranglehold over antiquities, but Egypt as a whole. I said I was going to ask you this question, but I've got another one now. So what do you think the reason is for that? Because we had Graham Hancock on the show, and I asked him, and he seems to think there's a lot of ego involved, and they want to say that they've owned the rights to this narrative, this history. But what's as sort of like a fresh face in the space? What's kind of like your take on it, Jay?
Well, I think Graham's right. One of the issues that you find in modern science, and not even really modern science, all you've got to do is go back all the way through civilization to see how dogmatic institutionalized ideas can become. You know, Galileo and so many other examples of us just saying, no, you're wrong, and we're going to punish you for being wrong, the consensus and the status quo. So, you know, Graham's not wrong in regards to that. He, I think, views that through a kind of a lens of, you know, just adherence to a model, blind adherence to a model. And there's definitely an element of that. I would probably go a little further and say that there's also some very drastic implications in regards to that particular area of the world and the history of that world, and what the true history of that might imply for humanity. So I think that there's a lot of controversy. You got to imagine, you know, this model that we have for history, this idea that we have, that we've held up as the explainable framework for who we are as a civilization. It's come under so much stress, not just in Egypt. I mean, like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey and so many other incredible megalithic sites around the world that just defy explanation of the current model. Egypt, you know, there's the secret societies, the Hermetic orders, the things that came out of that Freemasonry was born from the Hermetic principles of Egypt and the secret keeping of that era. So I think that there's a kind of a multifaceted issue here. You've got the dogmatic mainstream science that's just channeled through very, very high walls of academia, and they're not really allowed to look outside of that. And so they just adhere to a model. But then there's probably another strata of power above that that actually considers some of this information to be too disruptive for humanity to understand. And so I think that there's an element of a control structure at play as well. But I would agree with Graham that a lot of it just comes down to dogma, you know, religious style dogma.
See, I always, because obviously, you know, it's kind of like power and money to an extent corrupts. I always had, and who am I to sort of have these kind of theories, but I always had the notion of, is there a cost element? Because these history as it's written is what gets taught and lectured in schools and universities. Mm-hmm. And obviously if someone comes along with these discoveries and these theories that rock the status quo, people aren't going to invest that kind of money into it. So I don't know. I've always had the notion, is that why? Is that
Well, you'd need to change curriculums. Like everything would need to change in relationship to, you know, how we talk about history going on from here in academia, you know, through education. So, yeah, the implications are quite far reaching in terms of an overhaul in how we look at history. And I think that we're just not ready to do that collectively. But I would also say that the alternative media space in all sorts of sectors, whether it's geopolitics or history or, you know, ufology or whatever it might be, there's a hunger and an appetite for information outside of the mainstream kind of like narrative controlled area. And I think that's only going to grow And so when you have, you know, findings like this from the Giza Plateau, maybe 10, 20 years ago, they wouldn't be able to do as much. But now we're in a different space. They can't shut down the conversation as easily. Podcasts are able to completely overtake the mainstream narrative control of the modern world. So I think that we're in an interesting period of time with alternative discussions kind of taking the forefront. You know, a lot of these mainstream historians don't have the following that some of the other guys like Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson have. Like, you know, there's a lot of people who are actually competitively driving this this conversation in the alternative space, and the media, the mainstream, can't really keep up.
Yeah,
you know, and it's struggling.
You know, having chatted to Graham, and obviously you could see it's people. It's so cutthroat. People,
oh yeah,
some of the, you know, the shouts that Graham's had, or the labels,
it's like high school bitching.
It's crazy. I know, having met Graham, he's a lovely guy.
Lovely guy,
you know, he's just literally there's no faff, or I don't see any sort of. There's no hidden agenda with him. I think he's just generally passionate and wants to find out the truth. And I just think people give him such a hard time. And, you know, let's address the elephant in the room. He's a senior citizen now.
Yeah.
You know, he's not getting any younger. And I just, both him and Samantha, his wife, lovely human beings. You know, he hosted us in his home to record the interview
we
had with him, which was a
huge
privilege.
Well, he got lambasted by the mainstream media. It was so shocking when Ancient Apocalypse came out on Netflix, and you just saw like Rolling Stones, New York Times, The Guardian. This is such a dangerous conspiracy theory, adult documentary. It's far right. A lot of like this is far right ideology. And a lot of that comes from the kind of like neo-Nazi beliefs of Atlantis. So a lot of the upper tier of the SS back in, you know, the Nazi German period were very interested in Atlantis and this idea that they came from a seed race. And so the like kind of far right neo-Nazis of today adopt that whole Atlantis mythology, which means that when you discuss it, people can then kind of claim that you're a racist or that you're trying to, you know, bring. And that's what happened with Graham Hancock. And it's just insane. I mean, he's a multicultural family, for the love of God. It's completely insane. But this is what happens. And they show their hand. They show their hand with how unbelievably biased they are when it comes to discussing alternative theories. And the only other thing I'll say with that is that saying that he was promoting kind of like racist and far-right ideologies when he's actually just listening to the indigenous stories, like he's doing what the West didn't do. We go over, we make an assumption about the culture and we bring that back and we teach our children. He goes out there to Peru and sits down with the shamans and the Sufis and the different people, the holy people, listens to the oral traditions. And they say, well, you know, this place, Sacsayhuaman, came from a much older civilization than the Incas. But then Western historians will say it's the Incas. So it's just like this weird dynamic where he's actually paying attention to the cultural heritage, the cultural myth, the cultural story, the cultural folklore, and being branded a racist for that. Yeah. So, yeah, it doesn't make any sense when you dissect it at all.
No, quite. There's a huge level of irony there.
Massive.
And it's, you know, it's like you said, I think I lose respect. So people, I don't really want to give him that too much airtime, but someone like a Flint Dibble who constantly shuts down Graham and you know, people who have this alternative view. They lose my respect to people like Flint Dibble, because why would you not want to be open-minded? I think it might have been yourself, because he went on Piers Morgan. I'd love this to be true. And it's almost like that's a smokescreen for what you're about
to
say. It's
so not. Yeah, exactly. Like, you can't say, I would love this to be true, but then go, oh, it's got all the hallmarks of pseudoscience and they've never tested it.
An incredible thing to claim has caused a massive response from both the alternative research community and the mainstream sectors.
I would love this kind of stuff to be true, but it is total bullshit. Using a method that has never been presented before in depth. It's never been tested. It follows all the rules of pseudoscience.
When they've tested it on the Gran Sasso laboratory in Italy, and they tested this technology on the Mosul Dam in Iraq, and Filippo Biondi, the guy that actually proposed this whole Doppler synthetic aperture radar fusion, has done it on structural integrity for bridges. Like, there's evidence of this proof of concept. So the thing with someone like Flint Dibble is he loves to say, I would really love for all of this to be true. But then he does absolutely no research to see if it is true and then assumes it's not true. So that means that he's a debunker. He's got an agenda. He's got a bias. He's not objective. And I don't respect him at all.
No. I mean, it always baffles me with archaeology, because let's say a chur was discovered in the pyramids let's use Giza. If it was a modern day chur, an engineer could say how it works, how the mechanism works. But engineers seem to don't get a look in when it's anything of a certain age, whereas archaeologists who have no clue on engineering, let's use Flint Dibble. I mean, I think his background's in seeds, isn't it? And sort of and nuts and seeds and archaeology around them. But yet he will proclaim to be, oh, I know how this works and everyone else doesn't know how. You know, that's the thing I never get.
And then they also make harsh critic about someone who's not an archaeologist, saying, well, you don't have the right because you're not an archaeologist, but you're not a structural engineer, you're not an architect, you know, but these are things that require the knowledge of an architect or an engineer or a machining, you know, expert. And so, you know, someone like, what's his name? Something Dunn. Ryan, is it Ryan Dunn? I've completely forgotten your first name. I'm so sorry. Christopher Dunn, who's an engineer who went out to Egypt, very famous for going out and finding so many of these machining tool marks that are just clearly evidence of something more advanced than copper tools and copper drills and sand abrasive, which is what they tend to say is used for these drilling holes. And they're just so clear and obvious. And so I think, you know, someone like Flint Dibble, not to put too much on him, but you know, there's a bias inherent in these people that just seems to strip away the imagination and the curiosity, which should be inherent in these fields. You know, you should be a curious seeker who's trying to find as much as you can. And what I find really frustrating about it is that there's an assumption that they're so methodical. There's an assumption that they've done so much work to, you know, conclusively say, well, the pyramid is this old, or this is when this happened, or the Inca civilization built this. But when you dissect it, there's actually just assumptions. It's just assumptions for the most part when it comes to attributing a specific time period to somebody's very contradictory sites. I mean, even with the Great Pyramid and the pyramids on the Giza Plateau, you've got signs of advanced weathering, you know, not just on the Sphinx, but on the pyramid itself. Even near the top where you've got this arc of extremely like degraded stone, and then it comes down like it's at the apex of the pyramid, you've got what looks like quite unblemished stone. About a quarter way down, it's incredibly degraded, and then it gets slightly better, but not as good as the top. So there's like an obvious degradation of the stone. And a lot of people have put forward that actually where you've got this arc near the top where it's incredibly degraded, this could be from waves hitting the top of that pyramid. And so the little spike at the top is surviving, sticking out of the water. And then as you kind of get down to where the waves are lapping, incredible degradation. And then it just looks like kind of typical water erosion from there on down, which would indicate that the pyramid was underwater for a significant amount of time. And then you've got the erosion in the Sphinx enclosure, which is just obvious. In fact, it was so obvious that when Dr. Robert Schock was standing inside one of the lines that has been caused by this degradation from water damage, the Egyptian government bricked up that particular area, which was just such an obvious chasm of where water had been pouring down. They literally put brick and mortar into it and filled it up. So it just, you know, it signifies, again, going back to what is the agenda here? There's an obvious desire to not let people entertain alternative theories about the age, about, you know, the origin. And again, I think it does come back to owning the narrative for Egypt. It's also a tourist trap. So there's a lot of money to be made in kind of like maintaining a particular historical narrative around it, which seems to be falling apart.
Yeah, and long may it continue falling apart.
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
You referenced Robert Schock there, and again, he was a geologist, isn't he? And obviously, so very reputable. I think he's, is it Boston University?
Yeah, something like that.
Lectures him. So really well-respected guy. And obviously, he was under such scrutiny.
Massively.
When someone who is an expert in that field has said that this is full of weather water erosion. And there was that test, wasn't there, that John Anthony West did, where I probably butcher this story, so apologies, but it was both Robert Schock and John Anthony West. Did they take photos of certain parts of the Sphinx without revealing what it was?
Went to
geologists and they
said, what do you think about this? And they were like, oh, that looks pretty clearly like water erosion to me. It's like, here's a reveal of what it is. I've changed my mind.
We didn't mean that, we'll backpedal. Obviously, going viral, Joe Rogan featured you on his podcast. Have you had any communication with Joe?
He's been following me on X for like about a year and a half, I think. And he DM'd me a couple times about the Giza studies, just like, you know, are these legit? And I was like, I'm not 100% sure, but they're looking really interesting. Like, you know, gotta talk about this, Joe. That's it, though. I've been very cautious to not nag him in the DMs. Do you know what I mean? I'm trying to just patiently wait to see if I get an invite to Texas one day. You never know. But yeah, like he's been following me for the best part of about a year and a half. So he's taking an interest.
You know? I mean, I don't know Joe. But I know what he's into.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't, I don't want to get your hopes up, but it wouldn't surprise me if you do get that.
I mean, I do tick the boxes for his weird interests, like for sure. But yeah, we'll see. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. And, you know, I hope you do, mate.
Thank you.
Because obviously, as already just meeting you, but following your videos, I think that you're going to be a good asset to this space. Yeah,
it's always good to see a British boy succeed as well,
exactly,
isn't it?
Who knows, you might end up being the next Graham Hancock, you know, sky's the limit. So for those who've potentially been living under a rock, pardon the pun, tell everyone sort of in layman's terms what this is, the technology behind it, and take it away.
Yeah, so Filippo Biondi is the scientist behind the scanning technology being used on the Khafre Pyramid project. And they did one on the Giza Pyramid, the Great Pyramid of Giza, in 2022. And like I said, it's been used on the Gran Sasso Laboratory in Italy, which is like 2 kilometers into a mountain. And they've used it on the Mosul Dam in Iraq and for structural integrity scanning on bridges, on highways and things like that. So it has been demonstrated essentially without, because I don't know the full technicalities of it, but it's synthetic aperture radar. So they're using these satellite-based companies that can scan using synthetic aperture radar, which, again, I can't break down the full technicalities of that. But they're using a variation of this, which is Filippo Biondi's patented method, which was patented in 2022, where they're using Doppler integration, so the Doppler effect, which is sound and light, the signatures coming from sound and light. Essentially, what they're doing, because this is one of the things that, again, people like Flint Dibble and others who didn't look into what the actual technology being deployed was, just went out brazenly and said there's no synthetic aperture radar that can penetrate 2 kilometers into the ground and get scans of 3D models. This is impossible. It's never been done. But what they're using is, for starters, they're using X-band microwaves. But they're basically scanning like 30 centimeters into the subsurface of the Giza Plateau. They're using these radar scans from satellites. And through this Doppler integration, which is Filippo Biondi's patented kind of fusion with the synthetic aperture radar, that's the key. The SAR technology, synthetic aperture radar, on its own can't do this. This Doppler integration where they're analyzing reverberation of sound signatures from underground. So if there is anything very large underneath the Giza Plateau that's made of stone and it's made of the same components as the pyramids and the Sphinx, it's going to be reverberating underground. And that vibration is going to be essentially registering on that subsurface level of the soil. So they're scanning the subsurface like 30 centimeters or less. Then they're reading the reverberatory energy, the signatures of reverberation and vibration coming up from the bottom, and using AI and computational algorithms to model that reverberation into a 3D model, which is when they got the spirals going underneath the Khafre Pyramid 630 meters down. And it's important to note that Filippo Biondi, when they first did these scans, he didn't believe it. He took it to the other guy, Corrado Malanga, who's a chemist, and was like, you know, he's the guy that's like leading the team, Corrado. Filippo's got the technology, but Corrado's kind of got the vision. And he was like, this can't be real. This can't be real.
The first time we saw these shafts, me and Corrado. Corrado told me, Filippo, what are those things? No, Corrado, that's noise. The first day, the first week, the first month. But the second month, we say, Corrado, we have changed the radar, we have changed images, we have changed everything, and always these shafts were completely visible. And so, how you say, by our consciousness, we announce it to everyone with a certain probability that is very high. People, there are the shafts.
2 months down the line, I don't know how this can be real. 3 months down the line, another series of scans. This is starting to feel like it is real. Two years later, after they've done 200 tomographies, 2 different space-based companies, a whole like variation of techniques and methodologies using this Doppler integration, and they keep coming back with huge spiraling structures coming down from the pyramid, extending into the, essentially what they're saying is that you've got like these 630 meter columns coming down into an 80 by 80 meter diameter box, which is about 600, 640 meters underground, an incredible depth, which, you know, doesn't really make sense. So if that's there, my God, we're going to have a fun time trying to explain that one in terms of structural engineering and what was possible, especially during dynastic Egyptian periods and the pharaonic reigns, because they weren't capable of that. So in short, they're using a novel but already tested radar and Doppler fusion technology patented by this Italian scientist, Filippo Biondi. And this is what's produced these incredible, incredible claims.
I didn't know that they'd had so many tests on it, because obviously, like we touched on, that you're sort of like mainstream academia, archaeologists will have you believe it's not tested. It's fictitious. I think what doesn't help the cause, and this is just speaking from a neutral kind of playing devil's advocate in that sense, is the kind of image which we'll have pop up on the screen now of this SAR, and then this AI produced image that's come out. It's kind of, I can see where they've gone with it, but I can see maybe to the untrained eye, they're saying that's a bit of a leap to suggest it's X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
What would your kind of response
to
that
there's definitely some artistic license being applied to those 3D models. But the original image that is shared is the one that's been thrown around a lot by debunkers because it's just primarily noise. But they've got quite a few of these scans, and some of them are very suggestive. I mean, you can see that there is a clear spiraling structure coming down. So I think, they took some artistic license for sure with those 3D models, but there is clearly something large and spiraling underneath the Khafre pyramid. So like that to me is what's interesting. You can't make up the signatures that are coming back. That's not noise, not when you've got clear geometry multiple times every single time they do the scans. So there was some artistic license, and I also don't think that they presented it very well, but I had quite a few Italians commenting on my YouTube channel saying, you know, these guys, they're really old school Italian scholars and academics, and they do not understand the Anglosphere. They don't understand Western style of promotion and kind of putting it out there. And one of their research affiliates was essentially just like, can I share this online? And they were like, yeah. So they didn't even really think about the implications of it. So that's why it came out through these random tiny little platforms. And I was like, questioning it because of the platform it was coming out through. I was like, is this real? Is this legit? And then their media manager, all due respect, I feel like it wasn't done very professionally in terms of like the visual aesthetic of it and the feel of it. And I think that played into people doubting it. And one of the things I said to my audience is that, yes, like the conference looks a little bit tacky with the big pyramid and the eye and, synthetic aperture radar. We're going to, blow open the doors of secrecy. But a lot of these conferences are like that. And the issue is that when you're dealing with something so controversial, like, for example, the pyramids of Giza and implications of large structures underneath them, you're not going to be invited to the mainstream conferences of archaeology. You're not going to be allowed in to present these ideas. They're far too against the narrative. So you actually have to operate in the fringe spaces, the fringe conferences. And I've been to a lot of these. I've spoken on stage at some of these conferences, and they're a lot of fun, but you do get the wacky characters. You get the weird ideas, and you get some of the stuff where you just go, oh God, that's definitely not real. And you have to operate in that space. And I think it's one of the reasons I'd give them the benefit of the doubt for the presentation of it is that they didn't really have a choice of where to operate,
No, it's good that you've dissected it like that, because I think that hopefully will be able to some of the listeners who maybe have been following this story will be able to understand it a little bit better as to why it was done in that method.
Have you noticed that in the UK they've done this now? They've like changed it so that you always got a hinge on.
All
the Americans were complaining on X about how our country's such a joke these days, and one of the things they're saying about how our country's such a joke is that we've put these little hinges on the caps now, so we can't take them off.
I've never asked. Look, what's the is that supposed
I don't
to be
have no idea. This is like a very recent phenomenon that's occurred. I don't know, to save the environment whilst we spend £56 million dimming the sun.
It's
plus investing
madness.
In solar infrastructure. Our government makes sense.
Our governments. I've just lost any faith in our government.
Yeah. It's not a good scene.
I mean, so you're saying that there's definitely something under the pyramids.
Oh yeah, like without a doubt, in my opinion, there's something under there. Whether it's exactly how they're presenting it with these 3D models, that's to be debated. But given the signatures coming off of them, the repeatability over a year, like I said, 200 tomographies and the same results each time, like you can't. That's the scientific method. Yeah. It keeps getting validated. So
I've kind of got two follow-up questions on that. So the first one will be, I'll kind of ask you in both and then give me a chance to answer. So the first one would be, what do you think is under it? And the second one would be, what's your thought process of us ever finding out? I ask that, I mean, I'm talking in an excavation, digging down there, having a look. I know at the moment it's looking never going to happen.
Yeah.
But as more things materialise, surely that has to encourage the Egyptian government, Zawi Hawass, to at least look into it a bit further. So I can probably ask you about five questions.
No, sorry, I got you.
But yeah, you kind of get the gist.
So in terms of what I think they are, Obviously, I don't know. I mean, the wildest idea would be like, oh, they're gigantic Tesla coils. Like, if they found out that they were made of copper or something, I'd get so excited. You know, yeah. It's like, what is actually this technological marvel? But it also could be like a hall of records. The pyramids seem to be time capsules of knowledge. Like, the actual architecture of the pyramids is completely saturated with scientific principles, and pi is represented, the golden ratio, the fact that it sits on true north, the fact that you can actually get like the circumference of the earth from the parameters of the pyramids. There's so much encoded into the pyramid itself, pyramids themselves, that in of itself feels like something that needs to be reverse engineered and understood, and you get the knowledge of whoever was building it. You know, they've encoded their astronomy, their physics, their mathematics, their art, their acoustic sciences. That's another very interesting element of prehistory as well, is the acoustic engineering that's present in so many of these megalithic sites, whether it's Stonehenge in England, or Newgrange in Ireland, or the Hypogeum in Malta. Like, there's so many of these incredible sites that are tuned to types of harmonic ratios that actually interact with human consciousness. So that's another element that's also present in the pyramids. The King's Chamber is harmonically tuned to, I think, 110 hertz, which is the same range that's associated with meditative consciousness. And so, like, you know, there's all of these implications about the acoustics and harmonics. But yeah, like, the pyramids themselves seem to be scientific reverse engineering projects, where you find out more about the culture the more you understand how they built it. But in regards to underground, that could really be the true treasure, like the real knowledge, the real artifacts, the scrolls, the information from potentially a pre-cataclysm civilization. That's where I lean. I know that that's where Graham Hancock leans with a lot of this, maybe not particularly with the pyramids, but he's very open to the idea of a lost civilization. I think that there is a likelihood that if these things are passageways, that it does lead to some form of repository of data, repository of information. They are like capstones. They're like time stones for civilizations who had a knowledge of these apparent cyclical moments of civilization, rise and fall, cataclysm, the great solar maximum and the glacial maximum. You know, these ideas that there is a cyclical pattern of destruction, rise and rebirth in Earth history, and that these are designed to survive through that, and for each culture that comes next to be able to decode and understand what came before them. So yeah, that could be, you know, the halls of Amenti, as they're known by Thoth, the priest of Atlantis, is what he's known as, Thoth, who then became Hermes Trismegistus in ancient Egypt, and this idea of a sacred sage, and he was the one that was supposedly speaking of, you know, these lost halls of knowledge from the pre-flood era. And also, we get the Atlantis story from Egypt. You know, it originally comes from Egypt.
I mean, like, I've always been a believer, and obviously thanks to podcasting, thanks to people like Graham, Randall Carson, and you know, people in that demographic space, I've always been, so I'm not someone who's typically religious. I don't follow a religious belief, but I am sort of spiritual in a sense that I can compare it to, we have a game, I don't know if they have it outside the UK, so apologies. Whispers where someone will tell a story, then they'll pass it on.
I don't think we're allowed to call it that anymore.
Are we not allowed? Is that not honestly,
at this point, you just don't know anymore, do you?
We'll roll with it. I'm sure the comment section will correct me on that. But yeah, so we have this game where it's basically a message gets relayed, and there's something else added on and added on. And I firmly believe that that's where a lot of, as you referenced, the Hermes, these stories come from.
Yeah, exactly.
So there must have been an element of truth.
Some root story.
The root cause of it. That's how I sort of look at it and just think, yeah, there might be things added on, like, you know, dragons breathing fire in one of the stories, or, you know, some of the Greek monsters that, you know, Prometheus and Hercules.
Exactly.
That's how I've always looked at it. But with regards to, let's keep it sort of on track with Egypt, is, as you just pointed out, there's a lot of kind of geometry, mathematics, science, astrology that goes into it that's kind of been proven. But yet, again, mainstream academia will have you believe that the tombs, when there's zero evidence of that, there's
zero.
Never been any bodies.
None.
And again, it kind of, well, we're saying it's this, this, and this, and we've got logical breakdowns, you know, maths, geometry, astrology, that proves that these are in line with what we're saying. Where's the bodies? How are you able to maintain this narrative?
It's infuriating. When you actually start to dig in, you realize just how infantile the explanations given for why they attribute it to XYZ. truly are, because again, you just have this incredible vast array of scientific, mathematic, astronomical knowledge that's encoded into these, plus the precision again of the site, true north, all of these different precise alignments, Orion star belt. And their evidence for example, the Pyramid of Khufu is that there was one scribbly little insignia on one brick that Zahi Hawass found and was like, there we go, it's Khufu's pyramid then. It's like, that's it. That's all you've got. You've got no body. You've got no mummy. You've got no similarities to the Valley of the Kings and the Valley of the Queens, where you've just got gold and calligraphy and hieroglyphics and motifs all lining every square inch of that space where these sacred burial chambers were for the kings and the queens and like the, you know, holy priests. And then you go into the pyramids, all of them, and they're just bare, completely bare, not a single hieroglyph. And so, you know, it runs in complete contradiction to the typical hallmarks of that culture, of that civilization, that they covered everything in hieroglyphs, which is just objectively true, because if you go to Egypt, you'll just see it on every single temple. but not on the pyramids, also not on, around the Sphinx temple, which some people believe is far older, potentially around the same age as the Sphinx, if the water erosion turns out to be true. Taking about, you know, 10,000 BC or plus. There's no hieroglyphs on those either. And they use a stone building technique that you then see echoed in Peru and other areas in Greece. And so, like, you know, that kind of signifies some form of a global pattern that, you know, this is far older and indicative of a global civilization. The lack of hieroglyphs, the lack of any mummies being recovered ever from the pyramids on the Giza Plateau. What is their argument? Again, once you start understanding just how much advanced science is present and architecture is present in the pyramids, there is far more evidence for the alternative theories of this being advanced, you know, energetic capacitor of some form, as contradictory and as strange as that sounds. You know, when you really get the fact that, for example, the core of the pyramid is made of rose quartz granite, which is a piezoelectric material, meaning it can produce electricity naturally under stress. And one of the forms of stress where it produces electricity is vibrational stress or acoustical stress. And then you have the entire pyramid made out of limestone, which is a natural acoustic amplifier, so good that the Greeks used it to build their amphitheaters, because you could hear from the back. You know, if the stone seats were made of limestone, the voice would carry all the way to the back. So you've got this literal geo-energetic coupling between the stones. The limestone produces amplified acoustics, the rose quartz granite becomes electrical under acoustic pressure, and then we also find out that the King's Chamber, which is made of rose quartz granite, is specifically acoustically tuned. So why would they need to employ essentially high-level archaeoacoustics into their design for a tomb? It makes no sense. So there's so many, like there's actually so many that it's hard to list them all. Reasons to argue against the tomb model, but that's what we teach our children, and that's what's in the books. It doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, I mean, I went in my real job. I went with a few clients to a natural history museum, yeah. Not natural history, sorry, ancient history museum. And it was so frustrating because when we're going down the ancient Egypt sort of...
I couldn't do it. It triggers me.
This is not like accurate. And you feel like saying to me, I'm just like, no, just...
Yeah,
you know, I'm not benefiting anything by saying
exactly.
This, but
actually, I think it's this. Like, yeah, okay, shut up, dude. But like, it's true.
Yeah, you know? It is frustrating. Okay, so obviously, like you said, there's loads of anomalies, and this would be like a 20-hour podcast. But the one that always fascinates me, and I kind of want to, while I've got you, ask, you've referenced a few times the Sphinx. Mm. So Graham Hancock's in the belief, and I'd say I'm in that camp, obviously biased towards Graham, I know, but the notion that the Sphinx is, you know, 12,000 years, and it was originally a lion's head, and it was because of the...
Leo, the age of Leo.
And then obviously, when you look at the current head of the pharaoh with its headdress on, it's not in proportion with the body, but the Egyptians were very much big on proportion sizes.
Exactly.
Where's your stance on the Sphinx?
I mean, pretty much with Graham Hancock on that. I mean, you know, I'm not versed in terms of astronomy and astrology, but the Egyptians, objectively, at least from the cultures that we know, like the pharaonic phases and eras, they were obsessed with astrology and astronomy. Like, they understood the stars and they, intuited symbol from the stars, and it was incredibly important to them. So the idea that they would put something there that isn't representative of the constellation that was currently in phase during that time makes no sense. I think that's Graham's argument for the idea that it was much more sensible that this would be aligned to Leo and the lion head. And so, yeah, I agree. I mean, again, for me, regardless of orientation, which is an interesting element to it, for me, the water erosion is just such a strong signature. It's such a very important one, and especially because they made active attempts to literally destroy evidence. I mean, covering up fissure lines is destroying evidence, right? So, like, that's what they were doing. So, yeah, like, I think it's far older, and there's been restoration. Like, you know, if you look at some of the original photos in black and white when it's still basically just sticking out of the sand, like, they've done a significant amount of restoration to reduce the weathering patterns as well, because those original photos, it looks old, like way older than it does now.
You've been to Egypt?
I've been to Egypt.
I mean, I'm going this year.
Nice.
I've had to go.
Are you doing, what kind of plan are you doing? Like, so, a tour group?
So Cairo for a couple of days.
Great.
Then go to Luxor. A couple of days chilling out in Sharm el Sheikh.
Fantastic.
As well. Just for the,
You'll love it, dude. You'll love it.
I can't wait. It's been on my bucket list for years, and I feel, especially having met Graham and you know, earlier on this year, you kind of feel obliged to go now.
You do.
And obviously meeting people like yourself, it's
I've been getting the itch to go back at least to the Giza Plateau for a few days, just to have another walk around, because, like, I feel like when I went, I mean, I was already researching things, but I don't really feel like I had the consciousness that I have now, like the research that I have now, to really look with an eagle eye and find the little machining marks on rocks, because so much on the Giza Plateau, like, you know, when you go, it's cheap to get on the plateau, and you can just spend the whole day there walking around looking at little, you know, tunnel ways going underground. And obviously you've got the pyramids and the Sphinx, but if you just look at the other temples and the other rocks, and you see evidence everywhere for high-grade machining tool marks, and, like, you know, just cut direct lines through the rock. And one of the places in the, I think it was Cairo Museum, there's like a massive block of granite, like this, I mean, literally about the size of this table, going all the way down, solid block. And it's kind of pushed into the corner of the museum room. So it's like basically in that corner, and it just looks like a big granite block. But if you squeeze yourself, and you literally have to squeeze yourself round against the wall to look on this side, and when you look on this side, there is a butter knife line just going directly through this piece of granite. Like, it literally just looks like someone took a laser and went zhoop. Huh. It's like, how do you explain that? And it's tucked into that corner. There are so many anomalies in Egypt, man. Like, literally, you could spend 3-4 hours just listing all the different artifacts, like the jugs and all these weird things that pop up that just completely contradict how advanced they were. Yeah. It's amazing.
I'm kind of glad, because I think if I'd have gone a few years back, it'd have been just to, tick that box, I've seen the pyramids.
Yeah, exactly.
But now,
you'll be looking.
Yeah,
you're
going to be observant. Definitely be looking out for that granite block.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I suppose with the pyramids, everyone has the theories. I know no one properly knows, but obviously, what we're taught in history, I think it's quite apparent both me and you are against the mainstream narrative. But how do you think that these monuments were built?
Or,
I know it's quite an ambiguously worded question, that, but how do you feel as though they were? Is there any sort of things from your research and what you understand that maybe it's leaning more towards this? Because I'll sort of put a word in your mouth and it might be completely opposite, but I'm hearing a lot, sound had a lot to do with it. Is that some of your agreement?
Well, again, like, the evidence of acoustic knowledge is apparent, and not just acoustic knowledge in terms of, like, oh, we can create a flute, but, like, we can build a stone building project that encodes specific amplifications of specific resonances. Now, that is high level advanced acoustic knowledge that really we're only just beginning to understand ourselves in relation to looking at these sites and going, wow, okay, that they were encoding this harmonic science into it. So there's definitely something to say about sound, and we already know that we can levitate objects through sound bombardment at, like, ultrasonic levels. Our technology is quite fledgling in that regard, you know, like tiny little pieces of plastic that we can make hover above an ultrasonic emitter. So it's difficult to say with certainty, like, oh yeah, they were using advanced levitation of stone through sound technology that was, like, dampening the mass of the object through specific acoustic resonation. It's like, okay, well, that's really awesome. I'd love for it to be that. I don't know if it is that, but it's certainly not log rollers and ramps and, like, you know, 5,000 slaves that weren't educated in high mathematics and engineering. Like, this whole thing is so perfectly done that the idea of invoking a massive, relatively uneducated labor force is nonsensical, and you don't see the evidence of that. There's no evidence of ramps. You know, so the standard explanations don't really make sense, and there's so many other instances of huge stone weights being lifted at times where they shouldn't have been. The Baalbek temple in Lebanon, the Trilithon stones, which one of them weighs like 800 tons, and we attribute that to the ancient Romans, who apparently built that because they built a temple above this foundation called the Temple of Jupiter. And we attribute the entire thing to them, except that the only, I think the highest lift in ancient Rome was like 450 tons. This is almost double the weight, and we attribute it to the ancient Romans. So it just, again, goes to show that we don't really understand how so many of these sites around the world got created. Stonehenge is another example. You know, how did they do that? And they all seem to encode this acoustic knowledge. So without being definitive, I find it very interesting, this idea that there's a lost technology of sound and acoustics, that when you're using the right geometries, when you're coupling it with the right harmonies, and when you're using the right materials, geoenergetic materials that are activated through sound or can produce electricity through vibrational stress, you know, you're getting to a point where it does feel like a lost science. And we're only really understanding that science through our own scientific mediums, and realizing that they're a lot more advanced than we previously believed with the acoustic knowledge. So, yeah, you know, there's other, like, geopolymer, not necessarily for the pyramids, but like the whole geopolymer conversation, that they were able to in some way liquefy rock and then reset it. That's another theory. But yeah, we only have theories. I would say that, you know, it's worth entertaining all the theories unless they really don't hold up to scrutiny. And so things like these ramp mainstream ideas, there's not evidence for that. So I would dismiss that based on the fact that we don't have anything to prove that. But yeah, in terms of acoustics, man, like, it's something I'm very interested in, but I wouldn't stake my claim on, like, that's how they were doing it. One interesting little aside, I wish I could remember his name. I might have to send you a link and you can put it up as a little like the book cover, because it's worth looking at. There was a Swedish engineer, it's got a Swedish name, that's why I can't remember it, who went out to Tibet and was basically allowed to study with some of these high lamas in Tibet, and was taken, at least according to his book, to this monastery where they demonstrated levitating this gigantic stone using like 200 monks all in a geometric pattern. Wow. With these, I don't know if you've ever seen the Tibetan horns, they're like the size of this room, these huge Tibetan horns. So they had like this array of horns and drums and musical instruments and like this geometry of people all chanting towards this stone, at least according to this guy's book. And he was a real and acknowledged scientist and engineer of his time. He wasn't just some random like kind of kook. And he said, yeah, they showed me that they could levitate these stones. Yeah. So maybe there is like a very simple, because we assume it would have to be like, you know, ultrasonic emitters and like a high level technology that could levitate it. But maybe it is really just about the right geometry, the right placement. And this is a lost knowledge that we haven't really found again. And it's only in these sacred halls and monasteries up in the Himalayas where they're keeping this stuff going. So maybe that's what built the pyramids, man. But you know, the mainstream explanation doesn't hold weight either.
No, I mean, I've just completely kind of ruled out the mainstream.
No.
I mean, one of the things I think Graham Hancock and people like that always say is we get too focused on looking for ourselves, because I think
exactly
people perceive that because we're alive today, we're the most advanced beings that have ever existed. And I think it disputes that based on, you know, the pyramids and all these other ancient landmarks. It's just, it's frustrating, isn't it? Because the mainstream just want to completely say, no, this is factual, this isn't. Mm-hmm. And I don't really think they take into consideration some of these claims.
No, and they want to insult your intelligence as well. Like, you know, just assume that you're just a wacky conspiracy theorist who isn't really thinking these things through. And I find that frustrating, because I try, at least, I mean, I do talk about weird things, but I try to pride myself on doing it in an intellectual way and discussing it sensibly. And it is frustrating when you're like, actually, there is so much more data on this side than the side that you're arguing for, but you're on your high horse saying that I'm a conspiracy theorist because I'm looking at the math, the astronomy, the science, the acoustics, and you're just looking at what exactly? I don't even know what you're looking at, because there's no mummy, you know, there's no bodies, you know, going back to that argument. So it is frustrating when you realize that. But again, the alternative media space is rising up in significance now, to the point where people are going, yeah, you know what? These archaeologists don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
They actually don't. And so there could be a sea change in relation to like public opinion and consensus on the model of history. And also one last thing is AI. AI is going to cause trouble, man.
Oh, yeah.
Like, AI is already causing trouble. I mean, I've used it so many times to like tap into strange little data points on history, and it can find little quotes that you never knew existed. Like, oh, here's a dozen different quotes throughout time about labyrinths under the pyramid from the ancient Greeks. And it's sped up the research. And so I think that's also going to be a controversy when AI is able to basically go, well, the mainstream model makes no sense based on all of this data and all of this information, you know, which is what I'm trying to do right now, actually, is like, you know, trying to use AI to like leverage historical data and correlate things that are counterintuitive to the orthodoxy, to the model, to the, like, the way that the status quo is running right now, and just fighting it with evidence, with data, with, you know, quotations, with references, with studies.
I think it's a lot of, you know, the population as a whole, society as a whole, isn't very open-minded.
No.
Certainly from my experience. Like I'm sort of in the camp of, if someone came to me and said, aliens built the pyramids, right, my argument would that be, okay, I'm open-minded to not rule that out, but give me a logical breakdown of that, why. And if they can do that, I'm happy to take that on board. I would never say it's factual, unless I genuinely believe what they were saying, but I'm happy to be open-minded enough. We don't know how they were built, so that's a possible factor. But with like case in point with the mainstream academia, sorry to bring this point up again, but saying that the tombs, when they can't elaborate on that, they can't give any sort of logical breakdown on that, but we're supposed to believe that. That's where I think the lines are very much blurred in all aspects. So just keeping it on the
plateau at the moment. It doesn't match up with what you're seeing. It's like, you know, don't believe your lying eyes is essentially what they're telling you.
Yeah.
It's quite Orwellian in terms of like there's just this mountain of evidence that contradicts what they're saying, and then they're saying this one thing, and somehow they get treated as the, you know, the righteous scholars and the ones that were doing the good work. And I just don't agree with that. I find that, you know, when it comes to a global synthesis at the same time, because regardless of just the Giza Plateau, like I said, there is a global pattern of shared archaeology, shared advancement in stone building from what are primarily, when you speak to the indigenous cultures, lost civilizations. They're not attributed to that civilization. We do it. We attribute to the Incas or the ancient Greece or Rome with the, you know, Temple of Jupiter. But the indigenous stories almost always will talk about lost civilizations. And a lot of the times they reference giants, man. Like, I don't know what to think about that. I really don't know. Like, I've been digging into it a bit.
Yeah, amazingly, I've hardly looked at my notes for this conversation, but giants is referenced in there. I was going to ask you on that, because that seems to be quite being brought more to the forefront now that there was giants.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the common conception is that the Neanderthals were, for lack of a better phrase, incompetent. They were quite thick by comparison to how the intellect we as humans have got now, although that's debatable. But in actual fact, they might not have been. That's
definitely
sort of
weren't
in a theory now.
Yeah, definitely weren't. I mean, like the prehistoric, like this is the, really, this is what fascinates me, prehistory. Like the things that we just say, oh, that's prehistoric, Neolithic, Stone Age, Stonehenge in our own country. I mean, that in of itself is an incredible multi-ton geometric stone building, astronomically aligned project that also incorporates this harmonic engineering. And I'm sorry, like Neolithic hunter gatherers that were barely even wrapping a stick around a stone to make like a basic hammer, they were able to do this. It doesn't make sense. Like, that's what I mean by it is insulting, because once you scrutinize it and like correlate what you're seeing with these structures and what the model tells you was going on in human history at that time, it makes zero sense. And Göbekli Tepe is such a good example of that, because prior to discovering Göbekli Tepe, it was just assumed to be a region of hunter-gatherers. Like, this is a hunter-gatherer area, and there's no evidence of advanced civilization. Suddenly Göbekli Tepe pops up, and the mainstream tries to push forward the idea that this must have been then created by the hunter-gatherers. It's like, that doesn't make sense. How did they get out of their deer hide tents and, you know, just suddenly one day erect one of the most incredible megalithic sites, again with alignments, again with solstice and equinox? They had knowledge of the sun, knowledge of the stars, knowledge of acoustics, knowledge of mathematics, knowledge of incredibly hard stone engineering. We're talking granite and diorite and andesite, things that are really high up on the hardness level, you know. So they were able to somehow, without any, and at this point with Neolithic, we're not even talking bronze and copper, we're talking, they haven't got any of that, they haven't got literally any of that, and somehow they created things like Stonehenge and these other areas. Newgrange in Ireland is another fascinating one. It looks like a huge dome from the top, incredibly sophisticated architecture that mimics, whether that mimics this or this mimics that, can't tell which one came first. But when I went to Malta, so many of the stone building projects there just look like Newgrange in Ireland. It's just like, huh. So why are there these global similarities and this pattern? And the Neolithic Stone Age, I think it was the Stone Age, but it was the age of stone in a different way to what we're saying. They were using stone as a technology. They were using energetic stones in you know, specific alignments and geometries to do something that I think now, because we're so disconnected from the natural harmonies of the planet, the energies of the planet, and people can roll their eyes at that, but at the same time, the planet is it's got a gigantic dynamo in the middle of it, and it produces a toroidal electromagnetic field. Like, we can talk about this through science, but you can talk about it through spirit and the energy and the cohesion of the planet and the harmony of the planet. And it feels like whatever this culture or global civilization was that was creating these stone building projects, they were in harmony with the planet. Like, a lot of these sites like the henges and dolmens, which are like those like three stones with a large stone put on top of it, which are very contradictory. Like, how do they get these massive stones balancing on top of these three smaller stones? A lot of them are aligned to natural fissure lines in the planet. So that's also something that the New Age spiritual world would call ley lines. But there is a demonstrable science to it of fissure lines going through the planet where electromagnetism is focused. So it is a stronger current of electromagnetism going through these particular areas. And what do you find? You find henges and you find dolmens that are made out of materials that get influenced by electromagnetism, high quartz content rock and things like that. You find them all over the place connected like a network of nodes. And when you find parallels from different countries where the Giza Plateau lines up with somewhere in Peru across the same lines and somewhere like Stonehenge, it suggests a lost civilization that was using the natural materials of the planet like a technology. They didn't use wires. They didn't have cables. They didn't have superconductors and microchips. They were using natural flows of energy, natural focal like nexus points of energy, and using natural materials, creating natural geometries. It was all very holistic, but high tech in a way.
Do you think that was perhaps a communication tool? Or
maybe,
like, you're always hearing kind of myths that someone traveled from the mountains, from the oceans, and passed this knowledge on. It could be that someone had the knowledge of building and I can't think of the turn of phrase, sorry, but basically had an understanding of how to build these henges, these ancient landmarks, and when traveled to other pockets of civilization and pass that knowledge on? Or do you think it was just a case of it was in sync with how you've just described?
Well, no, I think it's indicative of a globally influential culture that was able to go around the world and influence cultures to do these types of building projects. I mean, you know, you can invoke things like the bow or the ladder or a dagger as things that would be intuitively invented most likely across cultures without contact, okay? Because it's something that's so useful and so fundamental. The bow is a good example. It just seemed to be invented everywhere at once. So that's got nothing to do with cross-cultural pollination. That's, I don't know, what do you want to call that? The morphogenetic field of collective consciousness and, you know, whatever you might think that to be. But this, you know, you're talking about multiple different scientific disciplines being involved in this, right? So you've got the architecture and the mathematics and the astronomy and the acoustics. That can't happen like sporadically, randomly. Mm-hmm. That has to have been a core knowledge that was being passed on and shared. And like you said, there's all of these cases of civilizer gods, Quetzalcoatl, Oannes, or the Noah, you know, all these different archetypes of people that have come from a cataclysm and provided the survivors with knowledge. And I think that that's worth paying attention to. There's over 200 cultures that have a global flood myth, and we still disregard that. And it's interesting because, you know, if you saw the same kind of thematic sequencing in chemistry or biology or linguistics, you would call that a shared ancestry. But when it comes to mythology, we just say that they were making it up. Like, oh, it's just stories. But when every country and culture has a story of a global flood, a global deluge, and so many of them have stories of advanced beings or, you know, some individual arising from that with the knowledge of building a civilization again. Yeah, like, we should take that seriously, I think.
Yeah, no, quite right. I suppose I'll ask you sort of like... debunking a few. Well, they won't be debunking as such, but it'd be kind of like your opinion on things. So what would you say on the stance of, I know you're quite big on UFOs, you said off camera. So what's kind of like your stance if someone said an extraterrestrial being of some capacity or UFO was involved with the creation of these monuments?
Well, you know, the great sage of ancient Egypt, Hermes Trismegistus, was quoted to have said that at one point, both the heavens and the earth were represented in Egypt. And I mean, I'm not against the idea that there was an interfacing. I wouldn't attribute the entire construction of the Giza Plateau and the pyramids to alien beings, but I think that there was some form of interfacing going on. And I'm so sorry, I should have turned my phone off. I think there's some sort of interfacing going on between ancient cultures and, I mean, you could say extraterrestrials, but I would be maybe even more tempted to go towards interdimensionals, something beyond time and space, because when you're, so a lot of the kind of Akashic records and, you know, these talks about collective consciousness and shamanic states, so much of the time you encounter beings that actually seem a lot like the Anunnaki and the gods of the Sumerians, you know, beast heads and wings and indescribable and multiple eyes. And I wonder if there was a more shamanic practice at this time period that was interfacing between you. I mean, you know, there are debates, of course, about what exactly it is you're meeting when it comes to DMT entities or, you know, these psychedelic realms and astral realms. But I would actually lean towards the fact that we clearly started off as shamanic cultures and moved through that into more civilization building styles of existence. And so many of the early cults we know were mushroom cults. They venerated mushrooms. So, you know, shamanism and psychedelic states and trance states were very important to fledgling humanity. Maybe this was the interaction, the interface with a non-human intelligence, that they were getting in some way information from that area. And this is something that even now we're looking at. I mean, Imperial College London only recently synthesized a form of DMT that can be intravenously given to someone so they can keep them in that DMT state indefinitely to try and map it, to try and understand it, because these are realms outside of the normal default level of perception that I think, you know, we have not explored, we have not understood. And there is a lot of mystery and there is a lot of insight to be gathered and gained from these novel states of consciousness that I think these people were cultivating. Again, you look at the acoustic sciences and they seem to be geared towards activation of brainwave frequencies, activation of theta and meditative states of brainwave function. And so maybe this is the interface. So they were constructing these temples because of the shamanic states that they've been engaging in for hundreds and thousands of years. And one of the things that you see when you're on psychedelics is geometries, right? You get this incredible sense of geometry and precision and mathematics. And that could be the beginnings of then going, right, well, we're going to bring these geometries down into the physical world. Suddenly you get Stonehenge and these incredible designs that are completely geometrically perfect and mathematical and aligned to all these natural energies. So yeah, to cut a long story short in terms of, like, you know, did aliens interact with us to create these things? Maybe, but I would actually lean more towards very strange states of consciousness and influence from that state. And that's something, again, that we're only really now starting to wrap our heads around and explore properly.
It would explain a lot, particularly sort of in folklore and mythology,
yeah.
The way the gods are depicted, the
exactly.
way they look, like you mentioned, mm-hmm.
Anunnaki, yeah, the Anunnaki.
It's very much, I can see you probably seeing something like that on an ayahuasca
exactly,
trip or
right?
a DMT.
Exactly.
So that would explain quite a lot. And you know what? Funny enough, I've never really thought about it that way. Certainly with regards to obviously speaking to Graham, people doing these psychedelics to broaden the mind, and mm-hmm. that's might be why they've built it. But certainly, as you were talking then, I was picturing the sort of where they've come, these abstract images of gods, of
right.
of you know, omnipotent beings. That
yeah.
how did they come to look the way they did, or how we're sort of believed with the hieroglyphs? And yeah, that does have signs of a DMT trip
yeah.
of some capacity.
Well, I think there's so much knowledge. I mean, you know, we exist on such a fine line of perception, and it's fascinating to me that a couple of chemical tweaks in your neurochemistry can just melt the walls around you and transport you to a completely different realm of reality experientially. And time and space can take on a completely different function. Linguistics can become like synesthesia, taste thoughts, and, like, you know, hear colors, and, like, everything gets mixed. So it's a complete change from our default level of consciousness. And within that place, this is, in my opinion, the same place that you get sporadic intuitive insight. So all the greatest minds from, you know, Tesla or Isaac Newton or whoever it is, they all have spiritual beliefs and inclinations and mystery kind of inclinations. Isaac Newton was an alchemist. He was obsessed with things like the Emerald Tablets of Thoth and, you know, Atlantis. And I think that, you know, people who bridge the gap between creativity and logic, like these, like, very fundamental elements of the brain, where it's like, you know, some people are very, very logic based, and that's fantastic for understanding the environment around you, but not necessarily so good for understanding that larger mosaic of what reality might be. Whereas the hyper intuitive and creative one, always in the dream clouds, always bringing new abstract ideas, but not very grounded, not very physically grounded. So the ones that kind of meet in the middle, you know, these intuitive scientists, these kind of spiritual scientists who understand the method of science, but also are bringing in interesting information from an area that we can't describe. I mean, you know, Nikola Tesla said, at the center of the universe, there is a core where all of our dreams and aspirations and ideas come from. I have not ascertained the location of this core, but I know that it exists. And I think that's powerful because that's the scientific acknowledgement that there is something else which gives us this inspiration. It comes into us through downloads. I have no idea where that is, but I know it's real. And I feel that, you know, as someone who is very musical as well, I'm a guitarist. I've been a guitarist since I was like 8 years old. You know, there are moments when you're playing the guitar and that no longer are you thinking about the chord structure, no longer you think about anything, and the music is actually some of the best that you've ever done. That is the flow state, right? That creative, intuitive flow state. And I think that's the same kind of state that these shamanistic cultures were cultivating. Like, we barely even acknowledge it, let alone cultivate. We actively suppress these expansions of mind. I mean, Graham Hancock would call it the war on consciousness, the war on drugs, the war on consciousness. That's what it truly is. And so I think that they were cultivating these states. They were going so much deeper into these transcendental states than we could, right? Who knows what kind of information they gleaned from that and why these incredible architectures are not just a demonstration of mathematical knowledge and astronomical knowledge, all of this amazing in science, but they're spiritual. They are profoundly important sites spiritually to these people as well. And that's clear from the burials around them and you know, the type of veneration. So there's a spirit science that's being lost, I think, to time.
No, but that really, really profound way of describing that. While we're down this rabbit hole, I can ask this question. What's your take on, for lack of a better phrasing, it gets labelled kind of like the Matrix in the terms of things are controlled, and maybe this could tie into academia with they don't want us to know what's really there. That's why they shut down these discoveries, they shut down these theories. What's your take on that? I don't want to get too political with it, what's your kind of your thought process, if there is one?
Oh, there is one. I mean, it's definitely popular these days, isn't it, to kind of like say like the Matrix, like fighting the Matrix and NPCs and all of this. Like I said, with the pyramids and with Egypt, there could be a larger control structure going on, something more sinister. But again, like Graham Hancock is right, people are so quick to fit into a dogmatic collective, and they're very, quite afraid, I think, of moving out of that model. And so I think one of the biggest issues really is this dogmatism that's kind of taken over and made science and especially archaeology and history more like a fundamental religion. Hmm. You know, it's more like a fundamental religion. And so I think it comes down to human nature, human psychology, you know, the desire to not be wrong, the desire to not make a noise. Most people are not outliers. That's why an outlier is called an outlier, right? Because they're the one that's like not in the majority. So most people don't want to make noise. Most people don't want to go, actually, you know what? I think this Italian team, they could be onto something. Have you heard about these quotes from ancient Greek? Like, shut up. That's ridiculous. Be quiet. They don't want to be laughed at. And I think that that is such a profoundly strong thing. I mean, I won't, like I said, get too political, but we've had recent examples of groupthink on incredibly global levels over the last few years, you know, and people still are in these incredibly strong belief systems around that, regardless of what new information might come out, what kind of new facts might be brought to bear. There's still a concerted group of people that are very much on, like, you know, the pro-institution, believe everything that you're told from these mainline channels of information. And it's no different in history. It's no different. I think that this is just, you know, setting aside any sort of Illuminati, global, New World Order, sinister cabal that could very much be operating. I think the reason why humanity doesn't budge very fast is just psychology, collective psychology, and not wanting to move out of the herd. Because again, and one of the things that you have to remember from like a primal level of the brain, if you acted out, if you were different, you were dead. Yeah. Because you would be kicked out of the village, right? So there is like something deep within us from a tribal point of view. Do not go against the group. The group keeps you safe. This is the community. And I think even though we've become more complex, down in the brain, that activates when it becomes a pressure point and peer pressure. And yeah, I think that plays a big role.
It, like you used the phrase there, it's almost cult-like in a sense, particularly with archaeology from a neutral stance looking at it. One of the things that always crops up, and you've referenced it a few times on this interview, is Atlantis. Mm. You know, I suppose people probably perceive it as, I mean, it's one of those topics that seems to just divide.
Yeah,
you know, people. there's no kind of like happy medium on the subject. I think what doesn't help is perhaps maybe folklore, movies, media, the kind of like Aquaman, for instance, who's the other one?
Little Mermaid or anything like that.
People kind of have this idea in their head that, you know, it's what was the new Marvel, Namor, is it? He's a... I don't know. It's irrelevant.
Jason Momoa.
Who played Aquaman? He was the DC. I'm showing me comic book nerd. Can't be that nerdy because I don't know the name. I'm sure his name was Namor. He was just fought the Black Panther in one of the movies. Yeah, what's kind of like Atlantis? We know it sort of originated from Plato, who passed the message on. What's your take on what you think the real version? Well, I know you're not going to say for certain, but your take on what the story is, the narrative.
Well, I mean, I just think it's very interesting, and I don't really understand why we dismiss Plato in this particular case as speaking in allegory and metaphor. He was very specific with his description of Atlantis, and he said himself in the books that it came from Egypt, but it originally came to Plato through his great-great-great ancestor Solon, who was a sacred sage of Greece, ancient Greece, and a lawmaker, very respected individual. And he traveled to the city of Sais in ancient Egypt and spoke with the priests there. That was where he got the story of Atlantis. The priests of Egypt essentially laughed at him and said, oh, you know, you don't know anything about history, you Greek, you Hellenes, Solon, you don't know. There has been many rises and falls of civilization before your time, before our time. And that's where they gave him the story of Atlantis. So they originally gave it to Solon, who, you know, returns to Greece and gives his story on until it reaches Plato. His two books, he mentions Atlantis, and he's very specific. He gives the measurements of like the area and stadia, which is the measurements of Greece at the time. He describes them between the two twin pillars of Hercules, which some people attribute to Gibraltar, potentially. But there's been a lot of sites that people have put down, like the Eye of the Sahara, the Rickart structure. That's another one that's circulated in terms of a potential location for it. I think it was real. I think Atlantis, maybe as an idea, was real. Maybe not specifically a city called Atlantis, but a culture or civilization that eventually got referenced as Atlantis. Again, it just falls back into this lost time period just before the Younger Dryas Cataclysm, just after the glacial maximum. There was a very critical window, a very interesting period of time. Just after that kind of glacial maximum was starting to melt down and before the Younger Dryas kicked in, you had several thousand years of relative climate stability, especially in certain pockets like Egypt and other areas. So it's interesting that there was this critical development window that we ignore. We ignore that. You know, you think about the fact that we've gone from horse and cart to superconductor in 150 years. That's nothing. So there's potential for several thousand years worth of development before the Younger Dryas Cataclysm. It's very likely that something could have been happening at that time, you know, an advanced civilization. So, yeah, I think it does lead back to a pre-flood, global cataclysm era. And that explains, I think, a lot of the anomalies. Because, again, the Romans and the Greek, they had access to technology that completely does not make sense for their time. Like the self-healing Roman concrete, this stuff is incredible. They only recently, I think in 2023 at MIT, managed to recreate this concrete. But even then they had to use synthetic variants. They had no idea how to truly make the recipe for this concrete that gets harder over time. And when cracks appear in it and water enters the crack, it calcifies and turns into more concrete. Mm-hmm. So it's like nanoparticle self-healing concrete, right? There are like these weird anomalous advancements in ancient Roman Greece that would suggest ancient knowledge that they were having access to, maybe from Sumeria or Mesopotamia. And even the Sumerian and Mesopotamian history seems to reference older knowledge coming from a more ancient past. So my question is, why do things keep getting more advanced the further we go back into time? That's contradictory, right? It shouldn't get more advanced stonework, more advanced technology. And yet that's what we see.
Yeah, and you've hit the nail on the head there for my take on it with regards to our sort of, for worse sort of like civilization as we know it in recent times, it's a drop in the ocean.
Drop in the ocean.
In the grand scheme of things. And you think how much we've advanced now, you know, currently AI is the in thing, isn't it? You know, AI and the technologies that we've got. But how could time, it wouldn't have gone slower during that period. Like we've not advanced like within hundreds of years, and it took such a long time span for us to improve things. So I'm very much on the fence of a lost civilization mm-hmm. that had advanced technologies that maybe we can't comprehend, we can't understand because we've not invented it yet or we've not discovered it
exactly. yet. Exactly. And also our history, you know, we degraded. I mean, you think about ancient Rome, then you look at the Dark Ages, you know, we literally went backwards and devolved. And so there is probably elements of that that we haven't even understood through previous iterations of history where we just forget these massive swathes of information that was actually once known. And also you think about things like Sentinel Island, where you've got a, you know, indigenous tribal culture that's essentially almost completely uncontacted by modern humanity, other than a couple of people that have tried to convert them to Jesus and get spears thrown at them and stuff like that. But Sentinel Island is protected. But they're essentially existing next to an alien civilization, right? Because they are literally throwing spears and living in animal hide tents next to virtual reality, superconductors, 2025, the singularity's coming, social media, you know, internet. That's a completely alien civilization to these people. Why the idea that hunter-gatherers of the past weren't potentially living next to, like, Göbekli Tepe, where we assume that these were all hunter-gatherers? Well, there we go. There's a massive megalithic site. So is it not more likely that these hunter-gatherers were existing next to people who were capable of doing that? You know, because clearly they weren't.
Exactly. It does. It's almost like everything's got to be uniform. Everything's
linear historical narrative, like, which makes no sense.
Yeah, it doesn't, because that analogy you just give there, we're living alongside
asymmetric development.
Obviously we've referenced a few times the Younger Dryas, and obviously, you know, I'm blowing smoke up Graham's backside this entire interview,
but
certainly with regards to his and Randall Carlson's theory. Are you on that fence, or do you have sort of like any different
in relation to what specifically?
In terms to a lost civilization being wiped out by apocalyptic events?
Yeah, no, I do. I think the Younger Dryas and like the Meltwater Pulse 1B do explain, again, over 200 cultures have this global flood myth. A lot of those cultures will attribute a more advanced civilization prior to that flood. And the anomalies that we pick up across the world that do not match with the known capabilities of the time period we attribute it to is all evidence that there is an anomalous chapter that just has not been uncovered properly yet. And, you know, one of the frustrating things, again, from mainstream history is like, you know, well, where is all the evidence? Where is all the evidence of advanced knowledge and advanced technology? I don't even understand that question anymore. It's literally everywhere, my man. Like, you know, go to Egypt and look at the machining tools. Go to Peru and look at the Cyclopean stone walls of Sacsayhuaman, which are multi-ton and fit together like jigsaw pieces and look like they've been melted into place. Like, and the artifacts, the fact that you've got these incredible Phoenician jugs that are perfectly balanced and mathematically balanced to the point where you would actually need a modern computationally driven machining technology to achieve that level of balance. And then you have that right next to like really bad, uneven pottery, which makes sense for the time period. So what are these anomalies? Where do they come from? There's a really interesting cup. I think it's pronounced the Lycurgus cup. It's L-Y-R-C-G-U-S or something like that. It's in the British Museum. And it's this incredible cup. I think it's 4th century. And it's Roman, but it's actually got nanoparticle gold and silver alloys embedded into it in a specific sequence that allows for a type of surface plasmonic resonance, right? This is literally true, that changes its color from green to red when the light bounces off of it and reflects. And basically the effect, this incredible like red to green shifting that looks so magical when you see this cup, it's this incredibly crafted goblet with this glass. The effect is only possible because of these like 50 nanometer gold and silver particulates that are embedded into the glass. So that's literally
what's the name of this again?
Lycurgus, L-Y-R-C-G-U-S, something like that. The Lycurgus cup in the British Museum.
Okay.
And it literally by definition is nanotechnology. By definition, because it's using in a particularly distributed manner nanoparticles of materials to produce an effect. So that's nanotech. 2,000 years before it was supposed to happen. So but again, you don't see these cups everywhere. So it's an anomaly. So where did the anomaly come? Where did that knowledge come from? And I think that we have to accept the fact that especially in Rome and Egypt and Greece, They had civilized hierarchical structures of governance and scholarly academia to the point where they could have secrets, special access programs, whatever you might want to call them, what we would call today classified research. Who's to say that some of these scholars didn't have access to Babylonian schematics and were like, right, we'll figure this out. And then lo and behold, you get the Antikythera mechanism or the Lycurgus cup or all these anomalies that are not distributed en masse throughout these cultures, but exist. So the fact that they exist, like, literally means that there has to have been other tools, there has to have been other systems and methods that are more advanced than what we attribute. You know, the existence of these anomalies demands that, and modern historians ignore it. Again, they're very easy and they're very quick to do incredible work on the things that they can explain, right? So if they can explain it, they'll do all of that brilliant work. When they can't explain it, they just seem to ignore it, yeah. You know?
And the ask was, come back to kind of like the whole purpose of us having this interview is the discovery under the Giza Plateau.
Yeah, man.
But people, you know, archaeology, mainstream historians will say, where's the evidence? And then when we provide a level of evidence, they don't want to know.
That's not enough. That's not enough evidence.
Yeah, so
but apparently a scribbly cartouche is enough to say a mummy was once there with no evidence of a body. Yeah. A double standards.
It's hypocrisy of the highest order. It really is. Also as well, just quite kind of want to touch on is it's going to get to a point where the more humanity goes on, we're going to discover more things. As tech improves, we're going to discover more things. Do you ever see there being a point where mainstream academia aren't going to have this leverage anymore because we do provide so much evidence, it debunks pretty much everything that they stand for?
I think so in core areas where there's dispute, like Egypt and the pyramids. Like something that you asked me I didn't really answer before was do I think there'll ever be like digging around the pyramids? I doubt it. But space-based archaeology is very exciting. If this synthetic aperture radar Doppler integration can be 100% proven as like an accurate way to find these things, I mean, in the interview, I didn't expect this. I mean, you'd think saying, and this is with Filippo Biondi, you'd think 2 kilometers is a big boast to say, like, you know, we can actually get this down to 2 kilometers. He said that that was tuned to 2 kilometers, and that they can probably max out. He was like, yeah, around 5 kilometers.
Well,
with my technique, which is the maximum depthness that we can achieve, let's say around 5 kilometers.
What? Like, if that's true, 5 kilometers into the earth, my goodness, like the things that you could find. So space-based archaeology, which is like this kind of emerging area of the discipline, that could open up completely new corridors. You know, you can scan the whole Amazon jungle. No more little plane with a LiDAR, like, you know, just doing a single corridor. You can scan the whole thing and find it. So, you know, I think that we're entering into a period with technological fusion and sensor fusion, and like these methods are going to be developed upon. You don't need to be invasive. You don't need to be drilling. You can find these things through these non-invasive techniques, which are only going to improve. So, yeah, I think that time's running out just because of the advancement of technology. But there is, again, I think when it comes to things like specifically Egypt, there is larger control structures around that in terms of, I don't know, man, maybe there's a group that just does not think it's the right time for people to know about it. Or maybe now we're entering into the right time. But with the pyramids especially, I mean, it's printed on the dollar bill, man. There is some serious implications to these pyramids from like the Freemasonry perspective. And, you know, I think that there's a level of information keeping.
With this new tech, is there a potential security risk? Because we know that there's underground military bases.
Yeah.
Surely that's got to be alarm bells ringing of,
yeah, dude.
If this kit gets into the hands of, say, Russia or even America, you know, what's the implications of that?
Yeah, I put that to the scientists themselves, and I think maybe I made them a little uncomfortable with that off-record question, just in terms of, have you been approached by military, any national security guys? Because if you can go 5 kilometers under the ground and get imaging, I mean, like, you know, so the example of the Grand Sasso Laboratory, which is this laboratory in the mountains of Italy that they did a scan on, this is 2 kilometers into the bedrock, and they were able to get these imagery signatures that indicated that there was a structure within this mountain. You know, there are deep underground military bases all over the world, and especially in America. I would imagine that they would be very concerned about a team of scientists that are independently hiring out space companies and scanning 5 kilometers into the ground. Like, they will find things. 100% they'll find things. So they he was like, Filippo was like, well, we wouldn't use it for that. I was like, well, yeah, but like, yeah, someone would. Like, yeah, like, yeah, someone would, right? Surely. Yeah. So if this all goes quiet and suddenly they tell us that their technology got seized under the National Secrecy Act, then I wouldn't be surprised. No, but yeah. I hope not.
I hope not, but I've got a feeling it would be worrying. Degree, it's imminent. Okay, Jay, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, buddy.
It's been awesome, bro.
I've really been insightful, and I wish this could go on for much longer. But just a couple of things. Obviously, we said at the start, I'll link in everything for anyone to get in touch with you. Have you got any projects in the pipeline that you can talk about that you want to share? Is there anything you want to endorse? And fundamentally, what do you see being the next steps for this whole discovery?
Well, in terms of my own work, the only thing I've really got to share in terms of a project is a documentary on Malta. So I recently went to the islands of Malta, and that area of the world has the largest concentration of prehistoric megalithic stone building sites in the world. So it's this incredible kind of archipelago of islands that have amazing, amazing ancient prehistoric architecture. Again, going back to that whole Neolithic type of mentality. How did that happen if this is what human consciousness was at that time? So yeah, I'm working on that. This whole thing kicked off as I was trying to get into the post-production phase of doing a documentary. So I'm like a bit behind schedule on that. That's my next big project. I am going to be speaking on stage and kind of hosting a Q&A with the Italian team behind the Khafre Pyramid project. That's happening on the 20th to the 23rd of June in North Carolina the Cosmic Summit Conference 2025. So if anyone wants to check that out, you can go on cosmicsummitconference.com and book tickets and come and join us as we discuss the new findings and new studies that they're going to be doing, because this has, hasn't finished yet. They have a lot more to do, and they have even got more scans and studies that they haven't released to the public. So there's more to happen with the Egyptian kind of Khafre pyramids scans and studies. The scientists are going to be there. All of them are going to be there. So it's kind of like quite unique, and it's going to be in English. So that'll be awesome. Aside from that, documentary coming up into this conference. And if you want to follow me on X, it's at The Project Unity. And if you want to watch me on YouTube, it's Project Unity. Aside from that, I'm terrible at managing my social media. Like I've told you, like I have got no Instagram. I've got no TikTok. But yeah, if you want to check me out on those platforms, always appreciated. And we'll just have to see where it goes with this pyramid study. I don't think it's the end of the line, but it's going to take a while. Like I said to you, with these non-invasive techniques, it's not like they can just go and drill. You know, I've seen a lot of comments from people saying, why don't they just go and drill? Like, of course they want to go drill. You know, any day that they were offered that, they'd go do it. It's the Egyptian authorities. It's the Egyptian government. It's a very difficult barrier to get through in terms of any sort of digging on the Giza Plateau. So we'll just have to see where the evolution of space-based archaeology goes. That seems to be the key, kind of scanning from the sky and revealing things.
With the Cosmic Summits, that's going to be a great networking event for you.
Absolutely.
Because I suspect there's some big names in the space.
I think Hancock might be turning up. I think Carlson's going to be there.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to meet some incredible people doing that. Envious in that sense. I mean, he won't mind me saying this, I'm sure. Obviously, Graham's keeping quiet on the whole Giza discovery. And I don't blame him.
Yeah, he's got a lot to stake on this.
So obviously, we want to put that pressure on Graham. But obviously, I let him know that he's doing this interview. Yeah. And he's, of course, going to watch it.
Yeah.
Hopefully, you get to meet him at the Cosmic
Summit.
I hope so.
And look forward to having him on the show at some point as well, because he's just such a guy.
You two together, it'd be kind of like the universe imploding. It'd be a lot of fun in every positive sense.
It'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, that should be pretty cool. The last question we ask all our guests is, what are you now grateful for in life?
I think because of everything I cover, and a lot of it is quite controversial, and a lot of people that I speak to within my audience feel very alone because their family and friends don't appreciate what they're interested in. And I'm very blessed to have a very supportive family who are so proud of everything I've been doing over the last few years. And so I think that's what I'm most appreciative for, is the support of my friends and family, because especially in these subjects, if you feel like you're alone, you can feel like you're just crazy. And it's very useful to have people backing you up and in your corner. So big respect to friends and fam.
Awesome. And yeah, I completely agree. Mm. You know, I think there's got to be a layer of thick skin resilience, particularly in this space.
Developed over time.
As you
developed
know, we're going viral. It's, you're probably got to be subject to a lot of criticism and pushback.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter how many positive comments, it can be 100 positive and just one like, you suck, Jay. And I'm like, God, why do I suck? Like, what is it? It's like always, you know.
I mean, you've got a much bigger platform than me. But my sort, and I actually picked this up off Joe Rogan, the phrase of, post and ghost.
Yeah,
put
post
your
and
stuff
ghost.
Out
yeah, yeah.
and just ignore. Yeah. Even the positive ones, just ignore them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a balance because like sometimes people feel like you don't interact with them enough. So you've got to kind of strike a bit of a balance. But he is right about that. I think once you hit a certain point as well, I mean, on X, like I don't read the comments anymore. It's too stressful, man.
There's not enough hours in a day.
There's not enough hours in a day.
It really is.
Not enough.
But sort of advice, definitely get either someone or pick up on your social media
because
that will open so many doors for you, like on Instagram, Facebook, and
it's gotta
all that
be done.
Kind of stuff.
Got to be done at some point.
But you know what, Jay? It's been a privilege, mate. And I mean, I've enjoyed every.
I've had a great time, Daniel. No, it's
love
been awesome,
this
bro.
Stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm made up. You've had a good time. Thanks for traveling up to do it.
Yeah.
And you know, wish you all the best with future endeavours. I'll definitely be keeping tabs on your work. If you want to keep tabs on Jay's work, obviously, as we keep reiterating, all his social media handles and contact details. Have you got a website as well?
No, I'm terrible, guys.
The website would have been
terrible.
Certainly all his social media.
Literally just
X.
two links. Easy to remember.
But we'll put everything there. I'm also going to put the interview you did with the Italian scientists on there, and I highly recommend it. It's a really good point. Considering that's not their first language.
Oh my God,
really,
right? They crushed
executed
it.
Executed
well. Anyone who's got a problem with that, like, do you speak a second language? Quiet.
I struggle with English,
exactly.
And that's my first language.
I had to put a couple of subtitles in there at some point. I hope he wasn't insulted when he rewatched that. Like, like adding little context lines. But no, they did a great job. They did a great job.
They'll have been grateful for the platform.
Exactly. Yeah.
Fantastic. Been a pleasure meeting you, mate.
Same to you, Daniel.
Yeah, well, hopefully we do some more things in the future.
Yeah.
Maybe me, you, and Graham get together.
That would be cool. Yeah. That would be cool.
But until that day arrives, thanks again, mate.
You're welcome.
What is under the Giza Plateau? That is the question that so many of us right now are asking in light of the recent revelations from the Khafre Pyramid Project team, who have been studying and scanning the Giza Pyramid Complex, and specifically the Khafre Pyramid, for over a year, leveraging groundbreaking methodologies in synthetic aperture radar and Doppler techniques, through which they've produced incredible scans that indicate massive 630-meter structures coming down from the base of the Khafre Pyramid deep into the bedrock. Joining me now is George Howard, founder and organizer of the Cosmic Summit Conference, the world's number one heterodox history gathering, where the Khafre Pyramid team will be joining myself and a number of incredible speakers next month in North Carolina. I can't wait to be involved to speak with the research team behind these studies in more depth. So, George, can you tell people about the Cosmic Summit? When is this going down? Who's going to be speaking? And how can people get involved?
Thanks, Jay. Great to be on your channel. Cosmic Summit begins on the solstice, Friday, June 20th, but it runs through the 23rd. We have two full days of speakers, 27 of them on Saturday and Sunday. And then on Monday, we have a separate ticket that's a deep dive where there's six different classrooms, we call them, where you'll spend 3 hours with the speakers to, you know, give you the real lowdown. So when you come out of the room, they know you know them kind of stuff, right? And that includes everybody from Randall Carlson to Scott Walter to Ben Van Kirkwick, all have classrooms. The main thing that we have for your audience, and I know you and I share this interest intensely, is the first public appearance of the Italian researchers, Filippo Biondi and Armando May, who stunned the world in March, revealing a new technology that could examine beneath the pyramids. And this is going to be their first public presentation since, and their first appearance in the United States. And we're going to have a press conference. Hopefully we can get some people interested that were, you know, it was splashed all over the headlines before. We hope to have people come and follow up and ask them some questions. The whole thing about the pyramid scan, I think the first reaction was, I want to know more. I think that's universally shared. Well, we have more in Greensboro. On June 21st, Saturday, at 1:30 p.m., the Italian pyramid scan researchers are going to give another reveal. We got a big show this year. We got a premiere of an Atlantis documentary coming Saturday night at 9 p.m., and that's called Atlantica, and the producer, Michael Donnellan, and also the star of the movie. I've watched it. It's a docuseries, and it has an absolutely astounding conclusion, and I am sworn to secrecy about it. Hands-on with the pre-dynastic Egyptian vases that fascinates everyone. They are actually going to be physically available to us, compliments of Matt Bell of the Limitless Podcast. And Matt will be bringing a portion of his collection. I do not know how large, but I do suspect it'll be the largest public display of such objects since Amenhotep stuffed them in the basement of Saqqara. There are not many opportunities to go see more than a handful of these, and they're going to be in Greensboro. Hugh Newman's going to do an immersive kind of 3D experience room at Karahantepe and other interesting places he has explored around the world.
An incredible lineup of people, some of which I am really excited to speak to myself. Very excited to see the team behind these studies present their findings outside of the Italian conferences. Like you said, this is the first time in the United States. It's going to be a very special event, and the team behind these Giza studies are far from being done. There is so much more to get into. Will people have the opportunity to speak to some of these people themselves, some of the scientists?
Randall Carlson and the rest of these guys are your buddies over that weekend, right? It is a hangout with the gang conference. It's not a fly-in, fly-out kind of thing. And we wouldn't put up over it. Nobody's that big a deal yet, right? Well, maybe Randall, but he's a good guy, so he doesn't need to fly in, fly out. No, you meet them all. And, you know, it's a pretty well-lubricated conference. And we've got 10 cases of vodka left over from last year. And we'll have bars at all the events. So it really is, you know, as we say, a chance to sit down and have a beer with Robert Schott.
Now, it's not easy for everyone to get to some of these places physically. So is there a way for people to watch from the comfort of their own home?
They sure can. And we're calling it the virtual pass because the term live stream turns me off. Sounds like something you could miss, right? You can't miss this. You can watch it that weekend. You can watch it live. You can watch it a month later or your entire life, right? So you're going to get the entire conference, all 27 speakers, are available through the virtual pass. We're going to have three cameras, if you think of it this way. One camera is going to be showing who is speaking, right? And if there are two breakouts, there'll actually be two. Okay, but then we're going to have two other cameras, and one is going to be what we're calling the Cosmic News Desk, right? Where we're going to sit down and have kind of one of those kind of live, informal desks where people are coming in and out, not really programmed, where we take them back and ask them some questions. Wild, you can do this now, but there is going to be somebody, and we're going to hand the glasses around. Maybe you'll carry them for a while. I certainly look forward to it. And just go around in the glasses, talk to the audience, talk to the speakers, you know, kind of give you the experience of being there. But the cool thing is, a lot of these conferences, both business and, you know, spiritual and alternative history and whatnot, someone will charge $300 and $400 and have seven speakers. I don't know how they get away with it, right? But we're charging list price $75, and that gives you all 27 speakers, both cams, opportunity to ask questions, interact and text, and we'll be following that at the news desk. But if you use this promo code, 3CAMS is what we named it. The number 3, CAMS, right? 3CAMS, when you go and buy the virtual ticket, it'll take it from $75 to $50.
So, George, what do you think is under the Giza Plateau?
I know there's something under there because I went down the Osiris shaft and it scared the shit out of me.
I've seen enough images. I haven't been down it personally yet, but it's on my to-do list.
Well, I had to some up close and personal down. They didn't find that place till the 80s. And you think there's just one little shaft that they dug over there two-thirds of the way down the causeway or wherever in the hell it is, kind of off to the side, and they just happened to build that and put a, you know, 45-ton black diorite box down in it, and that's probably it down there. Well, first of all, when you get to the bottom and you look back, you can just see that it goes on and on when you hit the water level. So a little bit of personal experience. It's like, okay, I know that. And then you walk around the plateau and there's this gate and that locked door. And just like Trevor Grassi, our mutual friend, is so well documented. I mean, it ain't a few. It's hundreds of access points. So we know it's riddled with some kind of subterranean activity. How extensive it is, we don't know. But that's a fucking fact. Okay, it's riddled with it. Okay. Then you say, okay, if these people did dig around, we've just established that. They did another thing, obviously, too. They built this, you know, 2.3 million block structure above. What would they seek to accomplish underground? And if they sought to accomplish something underground, how accomplished might they be? I think they'd pull something pretty damn incredible off underground. My sense says that there's something more down there. Then we lay on our friends Filippo Armando and Corrado Malanga, you know, who have revealed this technology. And I think we're of the same mind. Technology progresses, first of all. We've had one of the most outstanding progressions in the last 2 years any of us have ever experienced since the internet came out, and that's AI. And AI is going to assist other technologies, and it's going to bring things forth, particularly large, complex data sets. And though I can't truth Filippo Biondi's complex math in the 22 paper or any of the subsequent stuff or his previous 85 publications, very dense technical stuff, I can't proof that. Okay, but I don't think he's been wasting 30 years. I believe the U.S. government surely got similar technology, whether they got to the same place or not, who knows, but we know exactly what is under that nuclear mountain in Iran. That's been a question, the biggest geopolitical strategic question, hidden thing question. Same thing in North Korea, right? And if you don't think a couple of thousand people are using a technology right now in the U.S. government that's more sophisticated than just synthetic aperture radar, then you have very little confidence.
Well, I think also there was just a lot of misrepresentation from people that you assume are very methodical in the mainstream academic sector. And, you know, there were some pretty blatant assumptions being made.
An incredible thing to claim has caused a massive response from both the alternative research community and the mainstream sectors.
I would love this kind of stuff to be true, but it is total bullshit. They're using a method that has never been presented before in depth. It's never been tested. It follows all the rules of pseudoscience.
When they've tested it on the Gran Sasso laboratory in Italy, and they tested this technology on the Mosul Dam in Iraq, and Filippo Biondi, the guy that actually proposed this whole Doppler synthetic aperture radar fusion, has done it on structural integrity for bridges. So the actual proof of concept was there, but there was a lot of reflexive, I think, knee-jerk reaction from the mainstream that they hadn't even done the due diligence on people like Filippo Biondi before tarnishing him as a pseudoscientist. And I think that was a big mistake, because the receipts, like you said, 85 papers, the man is an established academic in Italy and very much has the proof of concept with these types of synthetic aperture radar and Doppler integration. It's so exciting that we're going to have the opportunity to actually speak to and hear from these people all in one place. And so I am just so looking forward to discussing all of this and more with you, the CAFRA Pyramid team, and everyone else who's taking part in this incredible gathering to discuss the implications of human history, which is a subject of utmost importance. And hopefully we will see some of you in North Carolina at this event, and links to purchase tickets are in the description box below, so check that out. If you can't make it in person, you can still grab a virtual ticket and watch the conference unfold from the comfort of your home, with live streams and multiple cameras giving you a first-person perspective as if you were there yourself. So join us on June 20th to the 23rd as we challenge the historical narrative over at the Cosmic Summit.